ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Welcome to Speaking Out.
We're mainly discussing land rights and economic empowerment.
Aboriginal enterprises in mining, exploration,
and energy. I'd like to talk a little bit about Indigenous constitutional recognition.
With Larissa Berendt.
It's a fresh view coming
on ABC Radio.
We've got a responsibility as a sporting code to make sure that we are not overlooking the views, aspirations and equality of Australia's First Peoples. It's as simple as that. But we also say that we're game for everyone. And so in my role, it is to really try and make sure that that is the case.
In conversation with Tanya Hosh, this is Speaking Out. I'm Larissa Berendt. We're repeating some of our favourite episodes from last year. Tanya Hosh is the AFL's General Manager of Inclusion and Social Policy. She's also a passionate First Nations advocate and thought leader. Tanya was the first Indigenous person appointed to the AFL executive, and she's credited with transforming the football code for First Nations, women and gender diverse Australians. Tanya also helped start the Indigenous Players Alliance. She's held leadership roles in the arts, culture, social justice and public policy areas. And Tanya's been trying to get constitutional recognition for First Nations people for more than a decade, first as the co-director of the Recognise campaign and then as a director of the Yes 23 campaign. Tanya Hosh, welcome to Speaking Out.
Thanks, Larissa. I'm so excited to be having a yarn.
Well, I thought since we're going to talk about all the things you've done and achieved, we might start with a bit of what shaped you and where it all began. So I was wondering, ever since I've known you, you've had a very strong sense of social justice and a very strong commitment to the community. So where did you grow up and what shaped these values in you?
Well, I'm not sure where to start really, but I was born in Adelaide and I was born to a Welsh mother and have a Torres Strait Islander father. I was adopted when I was 3 weeks old into a family with a white mother and an Aboriginal father who's a Darug man from New South Wales. Grew up in the Blue Mountains. I guess not growing up in my own culture, I still grew up in Aboriginal culture, even though I didn't realise that growing up. Like a lot of us, I had a lot of experiences of racism as a child, and I remember being quite young and, you know, being alongside my mum at the shops and people not recognising that I was related to her and my mother was my world. And I remember that being really confusing and not understanding why we were seen as different. And then obviously I got cluey and realised why it was. But I think my experiences of racism had a profound impact on me. Trying to talk to my dad about those things and finding the pain that he carried from his experience of racism had a huge impact on me, and I think that's where the fire in the belly started, the injustice of that, how it impacted me in my schooling, particularly probably from the ages of about 8 right through till the end of high school. Was really tough, and that was really what drove me to want to try and make things better, not just for me but for anybody else who knew what it was like to live with racism.
It's probably easy from that to see the line between that experience and your body of work in the Indigenous rights and advocacy area, but how did you come to work in Indigenous affairs?
Well, I got a traineeship, I guess is what you'd call them these days, into the South Australian government as a school leaver. I hadn't been a strong performer academically, and, you know, there was an Indigenous employment program that I sort of found my way into. My family was thrilled because I had a job in the public service, and they thought that that meant that I'd be employable for the rest of my life, and that, you know, that was important. I came from a family of people who worked really tough physical jobs and had a really strong work ethic and worked hard for everything that they had. So I was definitely encouraged to go straight to work. After a few years working in sort of admin roles and even being a personal assistant, which was work I actually really enjoyed, but I wasn't fulfilled really because the content wasn't, you know, driving me to feel that enthusiastic when I woke up every morning. And an opportunity came to go and work in an Aboriginal Young Offenders program, again doing admin work, but at least it put me in touch with content that was important to me. And that's sort of where it all grew from. This program working with young Aboriginal offenders again reinforced, you know, the huge degrees of injustice, what happened in terms of people's lives in communities who were disadvantaged from an early age, finding their way into a system that just was not fair and reasonable, going into youth detention centres over time. That was really what set me on a path to keep looking for jobs that, you know, really put me in touch with community and really gave me an insight that I didn't grow up with in a direct sense, but it definitely resonated with me and I started to see how everything was interconnected.
I first met you when you were working for the Council for Aboriginal Reconciliation. We were both very, very young back then.
We were.
but it was also, you know, a time when it felt like there was a lot of change going on. And I want to acknowledge, I think one of the things that you did do from your role where you were at that time was to try and engage a lot of younger Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people like myself in these big national processes, which had been dominated by the same old, and a lot of non-Indigenous people. And that's where we first met. And I wondered what your recollections were of the time and what I imagine must have been your first job at the national level.
Yeah, it was. I'd spent a bit of time at the Human Rights Commission doing my third year social work placement, but this was a job that really put me at the heart of a major national conversation. I was very involved with a group of peers outside of work seeking to try and help bring in some new voices into those conversations because, as you say, they were absolutely dominated by a lot of the same people who'd worked a long time to arrive at that place, but there was no obvious way of working out how to contribute to not just the conversation but also to the work. And I was very driven around that idea. And that was the first time that you met me. But I remember following you through Black Women's Action Education Foundation because I was a supporter of that organisation. And I was so excited the first time I read about you being at Harvard. But my reflections on that time was that we were really at a juncture in the national conversation at that time, people trying to work out how do we use this conversation about reconciliation to advance Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander rights. And that, for me, was I couldn't get enough of understanding more about that. I wanted to learn a lot more about the history and how we had arrived at that point of reconciliation sort of being the focal conversation, and I wanted to understand what had not progressed in the past and all the other attempts and to try and advance our causes and seeing them reach dead ends. So when I met you and I was working for the Council for Aboriginal Reconciliation, it was a time where I was a big sponge and I was just wanting to be in the rooms where those conversations were being had, and I just wanted to learn. I didn't think I had a lot to contribute, but I just wanted to learn, and I knew that there was a lot of people like me who wanted to be in those conversations and wanted to be part of the solution, but it wasn't always easy to find your way in there.
You also then went to work with ATSIC, as many people of our generation did, either working directly for them or being engaged as consultants through their work. And it was a very special time, and we'll talk a little bit later on in a lot more depth about aspirations around representation and voice, but this was a very unique organisation and one that's suffered from a very bad reputation by non-Indigenous people afterwards. But from your perspective, what was that time like for you, and what did you learn through that period that you were employed by ATSIC?
I learned a lot about the importance of regional structures and those regional voices being able to influence the national conversation. And I, you know, working both at the National Policy Office of ATSIC and then later in the South Australian State Office, I definitely saw some very good direction setting and some very strong implementation and transparency between state, local and federal government through the instrument that ATSIC provided and the advocacy that ATSIC was able to have in place through the regional council models. Obviously very political in many respects, but it was such an important organisation, I think, in terms of making sure that representation was always there. Might not have always been perfect, and it certainly had a huge number of hurdles thrown at it over time. And I think you're right. I think it has suffered from much poorer reputation than it actually deserved. You know, sometimes our own people were overtly critical, and in hindsight, I think perhaps we didn't necessarily realise the opportunities we had by having that vehicle. And then, of course, we didn't realise that until it was too late and it was taken from us.
I just want to acknowledge one thing. When ATSIC was abolished, it did leave a big sense of loss in the Aboriginal community. I think, as you say, people thought it was, I don't think people realised it was as vulnerable to being abolished as it was. So it was quite a shock. But one of the things you did in that period immediately after ATSIC was abolished was work to bring together national leadership to start talking about where we go from here. And those conversations, see, I've got a very good memory, Tanya Hosh. Those conversations actually led to the establishment of the National Congress, which was, of course, the next iteration of a representative body. What was it that made you feel that you needed to bring the national leadership, which was, I should say, was no small feat.
No.
We don't always get on, and there's not a lot of kumbaya when that group meets, so it wasn't an easy task. Why did you feel like that was such an important thing to do at that time? And acknowledging that you didn't put yourself at the table, you just worked to bring everyone else together.
Oh, look, I was just so outraged by the quick ability, based on conversations by non-Indigenous people and political representatives in Canberra, to just wipe us out. I could see, particularly having worked in a state office and working closely with the regions, just how much was going to be lost very quickly, and of course it was. And I was just outraged by it. I couldn't foresee how we would maintain any progress that had been made and indeed advance beyond that without a national representative body. And I think, you know, now that we don't even have the National Congress in place either now, there is no established vehicle that is set up to be truly representative. And that's not to say that, you know, the Coalition of Peaks aren't doing important work and other national peak bodies representing the interests of Aboriginal communities aren't doing important work. But we don't have a consolidated national group to pursue justice and rights for our communities that is supported. We don't have the political infrastructure in place. We don't have a political party to do that for us in that sense. And so to me it was really obvious the next thing we needed to do was use the opportunity that we had to get organised and to think about what it was that we wanted. And, you know, I remember back to those times now, and I just remember it was a ridiculous amount of work, but we pulled off a meeting for 400 people over 4 days in Adelaide, and we did that in 3.5 weeks. And I think, you know, obviously there was a lot of work involved, but I think if anything, what it speaks to most highly is the motivation of people to be in that conversation and to recognise that this was a huge loss for us as Indigenous peoples.
We'd spoken a bit about how ATSIC was politicised and its abolition has led to a narrative that many Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who were involved with the organisation and worked with it or had benefits from it would dispute and are actually actively trying to change. It feels to me also that off the back of the referendum, there's been a bit of a writing out of the role of the Recognise campaign, which really did start to motivate and draw attention to the need for constitutional recognition. And of course, you were a co-director of that campaign, and coming off the ability to bring together 400 different Aboriginal leaders from around the country, probably well placed to come in and do that kind of work. But why did you decide that that was something that you wanted to commit to? And when you look back on that time and the work of the Recognise campaign, what are you most proud of?
Yeah, look, I'm grateful for the opportunity to have this conversation because I haven't really had it in a public domain. I was interested in the conversation about constitutional recognition largely because I saw it as an opportunity for nation building, for the country to have a conversation that it needed to have about the status and place of First Peoples in Australia. And, you know, we hadn't had anything like that really, perhaps since the 67 referendum. I was interested in learning the skills of campaigning because it had occurred to me over time that people who have an ability to help communicate en masse a particular message and help people understand, you know, a common idea from all, you know, people from all walks of life, understanding a common idea, that was something that I wanted to learn to be able to do because I felt that it was always going to be required. And the reality is that while we come from communities that have done incredible things in terms of creating change and advocacy and lobbying and policy development and protest and all of the richness that comes from all of that work, campaigning is a very particular set of skills, and I thought we need Indigenous people to know those skills. We had no model. We weren't promoting a model for constitutional recognition. Our job was to warm the country up for the referendum. And I do feel that if we'd been able to make the progress from recognise into a referendum, that we highly likely would have had a better result. I'm not saying we would have won, I'm just saying that I think we would have had a higher result, because certainly what recognise did and what it taught me was that the work that we did right across the country meant that we were having conversations with people from all walks of life, just talking about the intention and the opportunity for the country to address the constitutional recognition piece. As hard as that work was, as challenging as it was a piece of work that I feel proud to have been connected with. The people I worked alongside were incredible. We all lost a fair bit of skin doing that work, I think it's fair to say. We were maligned a lot by people who were against constitutional recognition, but even by some of, you know, our own people who were for constitutional recognition. I feel like one of the highlights was the work we did through the Journey to Recognition, which was basically a relay around Australia, having conversations with people in towns and communities right around the country. We were often pleasantly surprised by the number of people who were a lot more open to the conversation once they realised that First Peoples of the country aren't in our highest legal document.
And you're quite right. I mean, I remember that surveys at the time would continue to show there was about 80% support for the proposition of constitutional recognition. You went from that campaigning into being a director on Yes 23. When you look back, what were the highlights of the campaign for you?
Yes 23. I think seeing us get the green light to actually go to referendum to have a Prime Minister who made a promise on the night he was elected to say we're going to implement the Uluru Statement in full was pretty momentous, because there was no time wasted in making that happen. As much as it was a risk to have a referendum, I'm glad that we did. I know that it has come at a cost, but I also feel that the opportunity to understand what it's really like to create change through our democratic processes en masse with such a high benchmark in relation to having to get a double majority, it's not simply just getting 51%. Understanding the degree in which some people would work against our advances in this way was probably a bit of a wake-up call in some ways, particularly when you saw it in a very deliberate and organised fashion rather than in the casual way we often experience it. I think has taught us a lot, and I think it's something that we've got to reflect on and think about before embarking on the next piece of work. I think we've got to take the learnings from this, and, you know, the reality is now that we know there's about 5.5 million Australians who support us. I'm glad to know that. I'm glad to know how many there are that want to work with us on the work that we need to get done. But I think it's up to us now to galvanise those Australians to stay engaged in this conversation and help us to move forward more confidently, knowing what cohort of the Australian public want to see justice for First Australians, and really what it tells us about those people who decided not to vote for us. Understanding that not all of those people would have voted no because of, you know, a racist viewpoint, but there would be a lot of reasons among those that voted no. We've got to take really important, thoughtful lessons from that, and the opportunity, again, to work with people who are passionate and experienced in campaigning and getting that real-life experience of being involved in a campaign was invaluable. And I still remain, you know, really proud of the efforts that people put into this piece of work, which doesn't leave much of anyone who works on a campaign, particularly those campaigners that were working full-time.
There was an extraordinary moment on the night of the referendum when you were sitting on a panel on live television and the ABC called the referendum as lost. And it struck me that you were someone who had not only spent all of this energy on the referendum campaign, but had also done all of that groundwork with the recognised campaign before it. And there it was at the very moment that it was officially or was called as lost and everyone turned to you. I thought, what an extraordinarily a difficult moment to find yourself in, but you managed to lean into that moment with grace, wisdom and deep reflection. I was just wondering, how did you manage to find such leadership at such a difficult moment?
I always just try to be constructive in any opportunity such as that, because there's always going to be a lot of critiquing after the fact, and there's always going to be a long line of people who would have done it better or differently, and I didn't need to cover any of that ground. But it was a profoundly important moment in the country, and it just so happened that I had a seat on television at that point in time, and it wasn't my moment. It was a moment that really needed to consolidate our determined vision and, you know, rise above the negativity. It was not a moment to be squandered on indulgence on my part, and I tried really hard not to just have my own personal response in that moment. I wanted to remain strong as an example of, well, now we know, and this is not going to diminish us as the First Peoples of the country, because nothing can take that away. But we do really need to think about who we are as a country, and we're going to have to reflect on that and see what it tells us about who we are as Australians. And that was all I really had to offer. So I didn't feel like I had that much that I could offer, but it was important to stay focused on the long game, I suppose.
I thought it was a moment that brought enormous positivity into something that many First Nations people would have found incredibly devastating, and as you say, many Australians as well, who had fought very hard for the constitutional change.
I cried off camera, if that's any consolation.
Oh, no.
I did.
Well, I think you were allowed to. How do we move forward, and what are your thoughts on where we go from here after everything you've heard and seen through the campaign?
Yeah, having conversations with other Indigenous people, I think there's bit of healing that needs to be had. You know, people are speaking to me about, I feel like every time I walk into a room now, I have to assume that 60% of the room don't support me or don't see me or don't want me there. And I think they're very visceral feelings for a lot of people at the moment, from what I'm hearing anyway. And I've certainly had some of my own glimpses into that. But I think what we need to do is truly reflect on where we've been, what's happened, and not just in the referendum campaign, but across that whole journey from the expert panel all the way to where we are post-referendum. There's still other elements of the Uluru Statement that I think we need to utilise in the right way, hopefully through the truth-telling element that will enable us to have the kind of reflection about the things that we can do differently, do better, but also being very clear about what our aspirations are. I often think that our aspirations amongst Indigenous people are incredibly similar, but we have different ideas about how to get there. I think it's time to do a bit more of that reflection, and I do think there probably does have to be another national meeting of leaders, Larissa, but I won't be putting up my hand to organise it this time.
That's Tanya Hosh. I sometimes feel she deserves a bit more recognition than she gets for all the work she's done in the background for our people. Tanya's now AFL's General Manager of Inclusion and Social Policy, but worked her way up from junior public service and administrative roles over the years. She was determined to get a seat at the table in Indigenous affairs, and she's had many, including as the director of the Yes23 referendum campaign. But Tanya had been trying to get constitutional recognition for First Nations people for more than a decade. She was co-director of the Recognise campaign and says their role was misunderstood and misrepresented.
You're listening to Speaking Out.
It just comes down to showing, sharing, you know, respecting
the world from an Indigenous perspective on ABC Radio.
This is Speaking Out on ABC Radio, ABCRN, Radio Australia on podcast and the ABC Listen app. I'm Larissa Berendt, and if you like what you're hearing, why not rate us on your app, and that way other people can find us and hear our stories as well. We're repeating some of our favourite episodes from the past 12 months. Coming up, we've got more from my deep dive with Tanya Hosh as she gets a few things off her chest, including a major personal challenge she faced last year. But first, here's some music from Barker with her song For My Titters and a little language warning.
Barker! Black sister, where you going? How you doing? Where you been? I ain't seen you on the scene for a couple of weeks. By your means, stay on your own. You gotta do your thing. But please don't sell your soul for a couple of jeeps. Embrace your black skin and your race within. You're blessed by your blackness and your dark skin king. Raise strong black kids, prevent drugs in the bin. And you'll be bound to make your old people look at you and grin. Ha! Stand strong like the matriarchy. And titter, I'm higher than the stars can reach. You ain't gotta act different when it comes to me. I believe in your sister, take a walk with me. Sweet of the juice.
know the deep of her roots. Black woman in a white man's world. It's tough being sexualized, she's all we've left. That's enough, you're worth more than getting treated like dirt. Show love and give your sisters what they truly deserve. Respect, we're sick and tired of getting treated as less. Saying bad sex sells, but I got no products for pets. The way you treat your woman has you looking real oppressed. She got her law, you got yours, it's time to have it addressed. Ha. If she stands with you, then stand with her. Cause handing down this feeling is a bigger picture. Got nothing to do with your sexual preference. This is about our solidarity, that's it in question. Ha.
That's Barker with For My Titters. Tanya Hosh regrets not finishing her university degree, but she's contributed so much to First Nations affairs that she was awarded an honorary doctorate from Flinders University in 2022. Tanya's a leader in arts, culture, Indigenous recognition and also sport. Since 2016, she's been the AFL's General Manager of Inclusion and Social Policy. One of her early achievements was to get the AFL to apologise to Adam Goodes for how they handled the crowd abuse.
Look, I think, you know, for the AFL, this is a game that has prospered on the talent and skills and passion of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander players on the field. A lot of people think the game wouldn't be what it is without those particular contributions, because the immense talent that we see on field is some of the most exciting footy you'll ever see. And it's one of the reasons that I fell in love with football growing up in Adelaide, because it was the only time I ever saw black fellas cheered for. I took away something from that. People often like to say that sport and politics shouldn't mix, but anyone that's involved with sport knows that sport is full of politics and it is a social activity. And when you're bringing people together from different walks of life, you must be able to respond to where all those people are and where they're coming from, and the fact that they bring with them attitudes and thoughts and views. When you're a sporting code as big as ours, one in every 21 Australians is a paid member of an AFL football club, which is enormous representation across the country, so that means we've got enormous reach and we've got some responsibility, and we've got a number of, you know, a good proportion, usually in our men's game, at least 10 or 11% of our players are Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander, and currently in the women's game, it's about 5%. We've got a responsibility as a sporting code to make sure that we are not overlooking the views, aspirations and equality of Australia's First Peoples. It's as simple as that. But we also say that we're a game for everyone. And so in my role, it is to really try and make sure that that is the case, whether it be a non-binary or transgender person who wants to play our game, whether it's someone with a disability that wants to able to access our game or play the game, whether it's ensuring that we've got much better representation in the leadership and governance of the game. all of that participation counts and all of those things are important. And I don't find it hard to be passionate about working in Aussie rules football. It's been 7 years now. I love it. I love the game. But with the privilege and the access comes responsibility, and I guess it's my job to keep that on the agenda. And, you know, I like to think that sport can play a really positive role in helping reach a lot of Australians who might not be involved in conversations like the voice to Parliament through any other way.
What do you feel you've achieved or you're most proud of achieving in that time with the AFL? Because it hasn't been an easy role.
No, it's not.
I don't know the ins and outs of it, but I could imagine that it's not an easy role just by the title. But, you know, when you look back and, you know, there's a lot that needed to be done, what do you feel most proud of?
I think, you know, I feel really passionately about Indigenous participation in decision-making. And so when I started, out of 18 clubs, there was only one Indigenous board member, and that was on the board of the Gold Coast Suns. And now about half of our clubs have Indigenous board members, and I'm sure the rest will catch up in the near future. I feel really proud of that. I feel proud of the fact that we were able to see the first Indigenous person appointed to the AFL Tribunal, which was footy legend Peter Matera. So I was really excited about the fact that there would be an Aboriginal man who's a bit of a football god, highly credible, being able to participate in those significant decisions in the game. The first statue of an Aboriginal footballer being Nicky Winmar outside Optus Oval there, and not just him as a footballer, but that iconic pose of him lifting his jumper and pointing to his skin that was, what, 30 years ago now, and sadly that's still a very relevant posture. But very proud that that's the first Aboriginal player statue of a footballer in our history. So very proud of having that achieved. And an important piece of work for me coming into the AFL after what Adam Goods endured was helping to drive and create a more substantial apology to Adam Goods from the AFL and the 18 clubs. It was well overdue, of course, and doesn't take away from what Adam experienced, but it was important work for us as a code to do. It's very hard to address things if you don't talk about them, and the two documentaries that came out in 2019 were really the basis for enabling me to help facilitate that, and I think it was really important work. And so hopefully it sets some new standards about what we will accept and, you know, never leaving anyone on their own on field ever again.
It strikes me too, just listening to that, and we made light a little while ago of how hard a role like that might be, but you look at the history that you've just discussed, the treatment of Nicky Winmar was a culmination of crowd and player behaviour at the time, which is why it's so symbolic. Of course, Adam Goods' experience showed that continued to be the case. It strikes me that organisations like the AFL will bring somebody in like yourself as a way of showing they're dealing with these issues. These issues are systemic and they're historic and they reflect what's happening in the community. But when there's an incident that's ongoing, it often is the person that's been brought in like yourself who then becomes the person who's seen as responsible for changing it or blamed for not changing it. That role that you sit in with the AFL, I think, reflects the role that many Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders would feel they play in their institutions where there is systemic racism. They're there to show that things are changing, and when those things don't change, they're the ones who are looked at as having not met the responsibility for changing it. Assuming some of this is having some resonance with you, What is your advice for other First Nations people who are in that position? Because I don't think it's often acknowledged how much it falls onto First Nations people in leadership roles that sometimes they're seen as having to fix the issues and systemic problems that are completely out of their control.
Yeah, look, I think, I'm not sure I know the answer to that question, but it certainly, I feel like I haven't always manage the stress of that well. My own mental health has definitely suffered over the journey. I'm someone who lives with depression and has to be medicated, and I, you know, taking better care of my mental health has been a big learning, and I really learnt that in the recognised days. You know, I also lost both my parents within 7 months of each other during that recognised journey as well. I mean, it was not an easy time in my life. Taking care of yourself, I'm not going to say balance, because I don't think I'm particularly good at the balance thing, but I do think that you do have to try and make sure that you create enough time in your life for people who are going to support you, love you, and be constructive elements in your life. I think, Larissa, you've modelled this for me brilliantly through what you do. I think finding places where you know that you are safe and respected and cared about in the midst of everything that we all carry that is really hard is probably the only way to survive it, and the only way to, you know, also model for other people that there are boundaries about what's okay and what's not okay. And it's taken me a long time to learn that, but I think being clear about your boundaries and feeling okay about setting them is really important.
I feel like I've asked you about a lot of the challenges you've faced while you've done your work with such grace and commitment. But of course, recently and during the height of the referendum campaign, your health issues led to you losing one of your legs. How did you deal with that, especially during such a busy, hectic time?
Yeah, look, I've, as you well know, experienced some really difficult health challenges in the last 3 or so years. I got diagnosed with a really rare condition associated to diabetes, and amputation was on the table right at the start, but it wasn't something that I immediately was drawn to, of course, and there were other alternatives put to me after getting a second and third opinion, and I had a foot reconstruction, but that's meant in the last 3 years I've had to do lots of long periods where I can't weight bear on my right leg, and being on knee scooters, being in plaster casts that had to get changed every week. I've had 6 surgeries, spent quite long periods of time in hospital. I mean, working and doing the things that are important to me that I want to continue to contribute to probably helped me cope with all of the things that were fast becoming physically very difficult. And then, unfortunately, just after my 6th surgery, I discovered that I had another occurrence of that same disease, but this time in my ankle. Amputation seemed the only sane way to go, but it was still a shock. It was a shock to discover that this rare disease, that I had it twice in the same leg. I knew that my best long-term outcome meant that that part of my limb was not going to help me anymore, and you know, I literally had to cut my losses, and still very confronting. I'm still in a wheelchair. I don't know when I'll be on a prosthetic. I'm hoping that I might get cast for that maybe even in the next few days. But even then, once I get a prosthetic, it's a long journey to walking on it all the time. So look, work and thinking about the things that I'm passionate about, what's important to me in life, keep you focused, but it's also taught me a lot about taking much better care of myself. And the reality is, despite urging from my family and people who care about me, I didn't see that I wasn't in great health. And the reality is, I got a disease that wasn't my fault, wasn't something that I gave to myself, despite what some people have said on Twitter about it. But I just have had to face up to the reality of it. I remind myself every day that I'm still lucky, that people go through much worse. I'm grateful that people have wanted to accommodate me, to still participate as much as I can, and that includes in my day job and the campaign. So I was still really thrilled that after my history with the work, that I was still able to be involved right up until the end. And as you say, on the ABC the night when they called it as lost.
You mentioned the importance to you of putting First Nations people on the boards of AFL clubs, but you've also been a member of many boards, including Bangarra, the Australian Film, Television and Radio School, Indigenous Land Corporation, Circus Oz, and the Australian Indigenous Governance Institute. Why, from your perspective, is it so important for First Nations people to be represented on these boards?
Because major decisions are made in organisations and institutions that impact us. I think the more we're part of those conversations and able to contribute to the decisions that these organisations are making, the more we can try and ensure that they're making decisions that think about all Australians, not just some. I think governance skills and abilities, understanding how these systems work is important. You know, board work is much more strategic in nature than operational, and so it does give you a different line of sight to what you might ordinarily get in a day job. So it's also put me in touch with and surrounded me by people I can learn from, and it's allowed me to hopefully contribute positively to pieces of work that I think are really important. You know, I was glad that you were able to mention Bangarra and Circus Oz and Afters, and now I'm on the board of the Adelaide Fringe as well.
Oh, I just can't keep up, Tanya Hosh.
I'm not doing all of those at once, obviously, but I love the connection to the arts. The arts is another really, really important part of storytelling the Australian story and contributing to people's identities and creativity. I think it's a healthy community that really does ensure that the arts are still central to how we engage in the world. And I don't feel like I've got a lot to offer in the creative world, but certainly being around creative people and thinking about the importance of those institutions and the work that they do is something that I feel like is nice to think about outside some of the other work that I do.
I get that. I would have loved to have danced for Bangarra, but I think
yes,
I was much better suited to being on the board. Just finally, not surprisingly, given the many achievements we've talked about over our conversation, you were awarded an honorary doctorate by Flinders University at the end of last year. What did it mean to you, and what was your message at the graduation speech?
Look, it was such a surprise when I got the letter about that. I'm still not sure who
nominated
me.
Knowing you, you probably thought it was a prank.
Well, I must admit, I did read it about three times. As someone who never finished my university degree, and that is something that I do regret, it was nice to experience a form of recognition for what I've tried to contribute. So I realise from knowing people like your good self and others who've worked really hard to get PhDs, just how much work goes into that. And to have a formal piece of recognition, I guess, that acknowledges that I've also worked hard but in a different way, meant a lot to me. And I think it meant a lot to my daughter, Marley, and the family in general to see that, you know, some of the time that I spend away from them is recognised as valuable. It was a real honour, which I guess is why they call it honorary. Of course, I used it as an opportunity to promote the voice to Parliament and the emerging referendum primarily, but also talked about our collective responsibilities to each other as citizens and how important it is to move through the world wanting to ensure that people who are voiceless have a voice.
Well, I can't think of anyone who deserved the honorary doctorate more. And honestly, we are the better for having you as one of our strong advocates, Tanya. It's been such a great opportunity to talk to you because you are somebody who's often worked behind the scenes and put other people out in front. So it's been lovely to share with people just how committed you are and how much you've achieved.
Well, very kind of you. Right back at you. You know, I've seen your dance moves. I wouldn't discount the Bangara dancing, if, you know, I think you're selling yourself a bit short there.
Yeah, well, missed opportunity for Stephen Page, that's all I can say.
Perhaps.
Thanks so much, Tanya.
Thanks, Larissa.
That's Tanya Hosch reflecting on decades of advocacy and an especially challenging 2023. Tanya wears many hats, but her main one at the moment is as the AFL's General Manager of Inclusion and Social Policy. We'll leave you with a song from Cootsie Don, Let Me Know. A bit of a language warning here too.
If you love me,
if you love me, let me know. If you love me, let me know.
You gotta hurry now.
But I ain't really not so. If you love me, let me know. If you love me, let me know. Calling my phone, calling my phone.
Yo.
FaceTime, he wanna see my pretty face. What it do, he wanna know.
He wanna know.
Yeah. Well, my attention wanna keep me to himself. I told him keep it on the low.
Keep it on the low, low.
So good, I got him obsessed. Now he's stalking on my post.
Stalking on my post.
Spending money, take me shopping, he be doing the most.
But I can never trust a soul,
baby, I'm by my business.
I ain't playing games,
really out here chasing these millions.
With no makeup, still the baddest bitch in the building.
He know I'm the realest,
think he catching feelings.
But I gotta do me, cause when I didn't have it, where was everybody? Now I'm up, they wanna message me and say I'm sorry. They know I'm great, they told me don't forget me when you make it. I tell them where was your support when I came up from the pavement.
If you love me, let me know. 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 Cause you got me in the zone. But I ain't really know. So if you love me, let me know. If you love me, let me know. If you love me, let me know. If you love me, let me know.
Calling my phone, calling my phone.
Yo,
FaceTime, he wanna see my pretty face. What it do, he wanna know.
He wanna know.
Yeah. Well, my attention wanna keep me to himself. I told him keep it on the low.
Keep it on the low, low.
So good, I got him obsessed. Now he's stalking on my post.
Stalking on my post.
Spending money, take me shopping, he be doing the most.
Can you hold me slowly? Nobody know me like you know me. Hold me slowly. Nobody, nobody, nobody. Can you hold me slowly? Nobody know me like you know me. Hold me slowly. Nobody, nobody, nobody.
That's the show for now. Join us again next time when I sit down with one of Australia's most respected First Nations journalists, Lorena Allen. This episode of Speaking Out was produced by Sarah Allerley and Jane McAllister. You can email the program speakingout@abc.net.au and find us on social media via ABC Indigenous. I'm Larissa Berendt.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.